good day wherever you may be. Welcome to Observations. We've got Kirk and Scott here. I'm Craig, and we're going to take a journey down memory lane here today. Going to talk about a book that Kirk read by a very, very controversial author. I think who wrote some... 60, 70 years ago, you read him about 50 years ago, Kirk, and you decided to dust off his old tome. So who is this author? And then we'll speak a little bit about why he's so controversial.
Okay, Emanuel Velikovsky is his name, and he challenged the history and a lot of the science at the time when there was everyone believed in pretty much a steady state universe and Darwinism. And he challenged all of that by his observations of astronomy, geology, and history.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is now I'm going to tell you that Velikovsky had some really weird ideas. And and he'd be pretty easy to reject and debate based upon the weirdest of his ideas, which are that in the last 6,000 years we've had, you know, Earth go everything from being a moon around Jupiter to having cataclysmic events between the planets leaving their existing orbits in our solar system. I think mostly he was searching for an otherworldly cataclysmic event, and he and if he just had replaced the notion of planets leaving their orbits with the comets and asteroids, he probably would have been fine. But there is something that is to be said for anybody that challenges the accepted order in academia. You know, my son just received earned a PhD in medicinal chemistry. And I can tell you, you either toe the established line or you do not proceed. There just are no rebels. And that is particularly true in places like history, where if you were to take a view that is divergent from the chronologies of history that have been popularized by certain scholars, you'll be ostracized. I mean, my favorite historian, and this guy also has some wild and crazy ideas too, but David Rule, yeah. A Test of Time is one of my favorite books. He is lambasted by the academics and among history professors for his redating of the Egyptian chronology, but his evidence for doing so is really extraordinary. I'm personally very impressed with his timeline and the basis of it. But the you know, something that give you a great example of how academia just responds negatively to anybody that questions any of their precepts. You know, the explanation for life on this planet has always been the notion that life emerged from elements and came into existence by random chance, and then evolved from that first organism to more complex organism. The argument has been that, yes, while the math demonstrating the likelihood of the first life form coming to exist is essentially impossible, 10 to the 50th or 60th power, and that the odds of that organism then finding a way to nourish itself, find food, find a means to process that food, and then reproduce, it becomes even more astronomical going, you know, beyond maybe 10 to the 100th power, but just unbelievably remote, essentially beyond the known elements in the universe times a trillion to one. Which said that the impossible becomes possible given enough time, which was the basis of the argument, that all fell apart. And, you know, they even had to have a rebuttal in scientific the Journey of Science, the Journal of Science, where they and Nature, where they said we now recognize there wasn't enough time, and so the issue there was the fossils found in Greenland, which are shown to be 3.7 billion years old. The Earth was only formed 4.5 billion years, and the Earth only became, even the land on the Earth anyway, only became remotely hospitable to life about 300 to 500 million years thereafter, because when the Earth was first formed, it was extraordinarily hot because of all the bombardment of the debris that actually comprised the Earth. And to a large degree, most people think that the moon was actually created when a large asteroid hit the Earth after its formation and spewed much of the Earth out into space, and it coalesced as the moon. But the Earth was not habitable because of the asteroid and comet strikes that were so prevalent in that period of time and the volcanic activity. So for 300 million years after the Earth's formation, 4.5 million years ago, it just was, there was no way to have anything remotely akin to life on the planet's surface. But shortly thereafter, within maybe 200 million years of that time, the first life emerged, and we find the evidence in Greenland, which destroyed the given enough time, the impossible becomes possible myth of the whole concept of macroevolution. Now, something was presented yesterday in scientific journals. Are you aware of it?
No, I've been swamped.
Okay, yeah.
Is this the black hole thing?
No. Yesterday it was reported in scientific journals that that is not the oldest form of life on the planet. You know, where did Yahweh say that he first constructed life? Didn't he say out of water?
Mm-hmm.
It was waterborne plants, right? And they have found now that there's a fossil, groups of fossils. Quebec is the area where they've been found, that date to 4.3 billion years ago. Now, that's within 200 million years of the Earth's formation.
Earth. Yeah.
At that point, the land masses are not even remotely habitable to life. The only place you could possibly have life, and the sun wouldn't do you any good because the skies were way too filled with debris. But this life actually was created by volcanic vents in the ocean. And so it takes the timeline of life on this planet, the emergence of life on this planet, back to almost moments after the oceans cooled to the point that there could actually be
liquid. Yeah.
Liquid. And before the skies were clear enough that plants could live, because of the what enough transparency to let the sun's light through. For example, what that does, and scientists don't want to say, well, it completely disproves the macro theory of evolution. And by the way, what's interesting, too, if that was the first life, and you're not going to go much back further than that, because you're only talking a couple hundred million years. Yeah, for the planet to have it on. What's interesting about these tubes, very tiny tubes that represent the first life forms, do you know that the exact same, almost identical species exists today?
Worm?
Yeah, it's the exact same kind of tube-like structure and worm exists today that they found those fossils of that date back 4.3 billion years ago. So, in other words, the first life form did not evolve.
No.
It's the same now as it was then. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. Those of you who think that macroevolution is true. Okay, so that's to be fair to Veliskovsky.
Mm-hmm.
He rocked the scientific and historian boat, and therefore he was discredited. So as a source, you have to be careful if you mention his name.
I know.
Because most places, they would discredit him. Now,
well, they understand, like, you know, they were buddies.
Yes. Now, he did find some things that... that are interesting. For, yeah, it is true that David Roll is mixed in with him, not but just because of the alternative timeline for Egypt. But Velikovsky, essentially came to the conclusion after reading a papyrus, a very interesting papyrus. And in this particular case, typically when I read somebody in your letter here to me on this, speaks of this papyrus, and it says that papyrus seems to recount the same events at the same time as the plagues of the Exodus. And so first thing I did is, well, after looking up Velikovsky and getting an eyeful, I searched for that that papyrus. It's the real deal.
Yeah.
Why don't you share with the name of the papyrus, where it was found, and the dating of it?
Well, let's see. I believe that's the one in it's in the museum in the Netherlands. In,
correct. Correct.
And it's got even got a catalog number if somebody wants to look it up. It's Linden 344.
Mm-hmm.
And it was discovered originally in Memphis near the pyramid of Saqqara, which I thought interesting if that's the way you spell Quara.
Yeah.
But the papyrus, it was the first time it was bought and taken there. And the first time I think it was, I found that it was translated, was in 1909.
Yeah, now the name of this, just if somebody wants to look it up. Is
Ipuwer, I-P-U-W-E-R.
Yeah, Ipuwer. Its official name is Papyrus Leiden, Leiden, I-344 Recto.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's its official name, but it's known by...
This means it's on the part we're reading from is on the front cover as opposed to the... there's another term for the back cover, so...
Right, so it's... But it's known, if you want to look it up, it's I-P-U-W-E-R. Papyrus is, and it is in the Dutch National Museum of Antiquities. And the dating of it, the actual papyrus was... that particular
scroll
document, that particular scroll, dates somewhere in about 1200 BCE, and it's but it
well,
it speaks
of it's much older than that. That's
correct.
They,
right.
They
right.
That it
right.
Goes way.
Yeah.
Back.
So it's typical of the language, and the names of leaders. That would date to the, I think it's called the 12th dynasty of Egypt, but in that period of time, and
the Middle Kingdom,
right. And so, the likely time, because it's so dire what it writes. The interesting is that the date that is most likely the original was written. Is sometime immediately around 1450 BCE.
Isn't that amazing?
1450 BCE is the end of the dynasty of which this could have been written. And if you date the Torah based upon or date the Exodus based upon the Torah, the year you come to is 1457. BCE.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a contemporary, based upon everything that can be analyzed about it, it is a document.
What he had lived through.
Right. The original was written at the time that the Exodus took place. Now, what's also amazing here is that there is a bias, another bias in academia.
Mm-hmm.
And that bias we see every day in almost everything we read, whether it be alphabets and language and the Hebrew alphabet, whether it be the timing of the Exodus and the history of Egypt, is there is a huge bias to discredit anything
in
that is associated with Yisrael or the Torah.
Yeah.
And so if it's an obvious confirmation, the first thing scientists would want to say is, well, it can't be true because it's not true.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of like the whole, you know, the whole creation account where scientists originally believed contrary to Yahweh that the universe had always existed and that it was steady state. And Yahweh said, no, I created it and it is expanding. And here's when I created it, and you can use relativity to date his creation to about 14 billion years BCE, and it is expanding. And he says the term that I coined to describe my creation event was Big Bang. And so when scientists came up with the Big Bang, the first thing they wanted to say was, rather than affirming what God had said 3,500 years ago, it obviously disproves the Torah. And so there is a
quite great logic.
There is a prejudice here that has a tremendous track record. So if you follow your friend here, Velikovsky, he wrote among many books that he wrote a book called The Reconstruction of Ancient History. Is that correct?
Yeah, I have not read that one because it wasn't available to me back in the high school days of college.
Mm-hmm. But in it, he establishes a number of kind of key criteria, and he says these are the things that are different. He's got his thesis here. He wrote it in 1945, that ancient history before the advent of Alexander the Great is written in a chaotic manner. And it is entirely confused and is a disarray of centuries, kingdoms, and persons. Now, that is something that I happen to agree with. And I happen to agree with it because what I have found is that way too many people rely on Roman historians because we have so many copies of what they wrote. And most of the Roman historians, you know, dating to around the time of Constantine through the time of Theodosius. And I've read their writings, and the uniform trend of their writings is propaganda. Boy, they had the same hatred for all things Jews. Oh, God. I mean, you read their their history, and it is just absolutely preposterous at the things that they will say. And the more you read it, the more you realize these weren't historians; they were propagandists. Like, for example, that whole thing of Constantine seeing the sign before the sun and hearing under this sign conquer never happened.
No,
he doesn't report it. There's no historical evidence whatsoever for it. His propagandist, and the first time that he writes a volume chronicling his life, mentions nothing of it. And like 30 years later, he goes back to rewrite it, and all of a sudden now puts it in, but he puts it in a context where it was impossible to have occurred. So you really do have to worry about that. And the next part of it that I have found to be true is that ancient kings were perceived as gods.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, their exploits had to be godlike. And the length of their lives had to be godlike. Mm-hmm. And so everything about them is exaggerated. And so if you took all of the times that these people said they lived and the ages they said they lived, and you strung it all out, then you have more history than can fit into the timeline of history.
Put it in.
Right.
Yeah, very simple.
Well, yeah. Now, the other thing that I have found is that you have to be really careful with the Torah's timeline for a finite period of time. The period of time from Exodus to the flood, and from the flood to Abraham.
Oh, okay.
There are time for the length of people. The hundredth place was a horizontal line above letters, and they wrote largely on papyrus coming out of Egypt at the time. And the with the vertical nature, the linear nature of papyrus, that vertical line became almost impossible to read after the scroll was used three or four times. The inks were just not that good, and the texture wouldn't show on. So you had an issue. It was the Egyptian manner of communicating numbers, and it just wasn't sound. And so what I found is that, if you look at the Septuagint, which I don't use a lot, but if you look at the Septuagint's accounting of time and the Masoretic text's accounting of time for that period of time, you find that that the history of early Yisrael is shortened by about 500 years.
Mm-hmm.
And if you work that into the timeline, then you you quickly find that the history of Yisrael coincides very nicely with the history of Egypt and every place else that's mentioned around. And it's all you really have to do is look at the places where the Masoretic text, written around 1100 CE, mm-hmm. and the Septuagint, written sometime around 250 BCE, 1300 years older, differ.
Okay.
So that also helps on our timeline. Okay. Now, these things being the case, the part that you wanted to research, well, you wanted to determine the timing of the Exodus, correct?
Well, that's where it started. I mean, I don't think I can really get much closer than 1450. You can argue 1457. You can argue those. One of the things that Brad was concerned about is it had to be a Yobel year, but I'll be honest with you, I don't think
it was
a Yobel. It's got to be. All it's got to be is a Pesach.
Yeah, it just has to start on Pesach. I came to the conclusion too that there are a number of ways of looking at it. It is possible using David Roll's evidence, and he has evidence regarding Yosef as a vizier in Egypt, talking about the 7 years of famine, the 7 years of plenty, and the home of Yosef, and all of the warehouses that were built during his agrarian reform, and he does a really nice job of dating that, and he does a really nice job of dating what happened in Goshen in terms of the Hebrew slaves and the burial sites of all the male babies that were killed at that time, the mud and clay bricks, and the large population of Hebrews there. And, you know, if you look at that, it corresponds to the same time, the Exodus of about 1450-ish BCE. And if you go back from the first temple, which was 968 BCE when Dode laid the cornerstone, and 968 BCE. If you go back 480 years from then, you know that's how you end up with around 1450 BCE, which is not a Yobel year. But the thing that has to be a Yobel year is Abraham's affirmation of the covenant, followed by the beginning with Dode and then Solomon of the temple, which is 968 BCE, and then Yosha. Fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shavuah in 33 CE, all 1,000 years separated. So, you know, I think that's about the best you can do from a timing point of view. Could it have been 1468 BCE? Yeah, I think so. Could have been. But I don't think there's a way to ascertain that from the Torah's account or from independent history.
No, I don't think you can. Everything I read is the same comes about the same conclusion. You can't stretch it too far, and you can't go back too far. And it's so is it that important that it's a Yobel year? No.
Now, one of the things that has really caused people to reject the Torah's account, though, is just a mistake on what the Torah says about where the children of Yisrael were and what they were doing. It says they were working on building two cities on behalf of the pharaohs. And one of the two cities was Ramesses. And so they assumed that, therefore, the Pharaoh of the Torah was Ramesses. Doesn't say that.
No.
There were, Ramesses only means son of Ra.
Oh, right.
And the city was the city that was the son of, for the son of Ra. So the city for the sons of Ra, if you will. Well, all of the pharaohs considered themselves sons of Ra. They were either sons of Ra or sons of Amun Ra. You know, same thing. And so the city, they found the city. Ramesses found the city. Tel El Daba is where it is. And they can date it. They found, you know, all the archaeology affirms the Torah. And the timing affirms the Torah. But now it appears that the 10 plagues are also affirmed in a contemporaneous, a 1450 to 1460 document.
Right.
Easy to find. You can read the translations of the document. There's no question.
You can see pictures of the document if you're that good, too. You can.
I've looked at it. Yeah, the difficulty is, of course, it's darkened over time, and it's really tough to, even if I could read hieroglyphics, which I can't, it'd be tough to read. But there's a very good translation available of it, and your comments are all from that translation.
I made some comments, but the translations were done by A.H. Gardner, who was the 1909,
correct.
And they've done it since then. So
correct.
The beauty
right.
I had with Velikovsky was this time I can actually go to a computer and I can look up his footnotes and see what the experts say that he's quoting.
Right.
I don't have to rely on him per se.
Right. Yeah, that's what I meant. But the Gardner's translation of it is available online in its entirety. Matter of fact, I've got it up on a web browser. You can read his entire analysis of the document, and then I'm always careful when somebody takes something from the web that seems to affirm something in the Torah, because they're people are prone to make stuff up. But you can verify that what you're going to share is valid, and it was written originally right around 1450 BCE. It's a contemporaneous document with the plagues of the Exodus and the consequence of the plagues of the Exodus.
Yeah. So do you want to read some of it? I mean, you want me?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, let's go right through it.
Okay, like on page 3, where in my little note to you, so. I'll read it off as Papri, and we're starting with Papri 2:5 through 6. It says, the plague is throughout the land, and the blood is everywhere. And then in Exodus, the corresponding 7:21, and there was blood throughout all the land of Egypt. So nothing monumental there. But
yeah, and by the way, that's the one that everyone immediately goes to. In fact, if you look at the wiki article on this papyrus, the first thing they say is, you know, the Exodus events did not occur, and so people have clung to this document because of a reference to blood, and by seeing the two citations, they claim that therefore this is an affirmation of the Exodus. Well, guess what? It does read that. Plague, it uses the word plague, is throughout the land. Yeah. Blood is everywhere. And by the way, it's not just that, the first thing that Moshe did is he turned the Nile to blood. But he didn't stop there. He then raised his hands, and the rivers and the lakes throughout Egypt turned to blood.
Yeah, because, and that follows suit.
Right. And by the way, this papyrus doesn't say, there was an algae and there was some red. Mm-hmm. No. It says there was a plague. And it says it was throughout the land. And they said blood, not red, is everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It is an absolute and direct affirmation of the specific plague. The first of them, and there was throughout the land of Egypt blood.
Now, I want to keep something in mind, keep people that are listening in mind. Mm-hmm. And in the background, you have to realize that this is a scribe. He may not have been in the court. He may have just observed this, you know, as part of the government mm-hmm. people. However, he has no connection with Moshe. They're slaves. He ain't
right.
hanging around Moshe. He's just in the he's in Egypt at the same time, and in Egypt,
yeah, the right. Seeing. Yeah, the writer of the papyrus, right?
And Moshe has no way whatsoever to see what he wrote.
Yeah, the writer of this papyrus identifies himself.
Yeah,
he is a priest. He is in service to Ra. He wants the Pharaoh to take charge as a god like Ra, as a descendant of Ra, and he is bemoaning what has happened to the religion and the politic of Egypt. And so a lot of this, like the scientific community, the historic community, will write this off and say this was a propaganda piece written to lament the time of, like, around Nefertiti when things began to decay. Now, this is not a propaganda. One does not create propaganda that says that everything has
bad light.
Yeah, everything is horrible here.
Our God's no good.
Our God's no good, and I'm begging our God to do something because we've been plagued.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. This is written by a religious scribe.
And it's pretty
right.
scary to him.
Right.
And
right.
They read it.
Right. This was not written by somebody who was influenced by Moshe. This is someone who would have been in every possible way aligned with the Pharaoh. I think the Pharaoh was Dudamos, based upon the test of time by Raul Vakovsky comes up with a different name, but I think the Pharaoh at the time was Dudamos. And this is one of his religious leaders, which would have been the only people actually educated that could write.
Mm-hmm.
And he is the one writing this immediately after Moshe and the Hebrews have left.
Right. And then, like you said, he talks about the land, and then the next line on 2:10, he says the river's blood.
Yes, and the next thing, what did Moshe say? All the waters.
Moshe, yeah. And all the waters that were in the river were turned to blood.
Yep.
So he's being very specific on which things. Now we have the land, and now we have the waters. So.
Right. And those are chronological order also.
Yes.
The first thing was the river was turned to blood, then there was blood throughout the land, and then the blood in the rivers, same thing. Okay, what does Papyrus then 2:10 go on to say?
The men shrink from tasting, and then there's a word missing in the scroll, and then it says human beings and thirst after water. So we've got lousy taste, and they're dying for some good water.
Yeah.
Exodus 7:24 goes on to say, and all of the Egyptians digged around about the river for the water to drink, for they could not drink the water of the river.
So,
when I read this in high school, the thing that hit me
mm-hmm.
Was, and the thing that's probably kept me towards the path, was that I was a student of prophecy, and I couldn't figure out how that could happen if Yahweh was not involved. I didn't know his name was Yahweh at the time, but
right.
And then you've got history like this that says these things did exist. So all the scientists or all the people in high school say this ain't, or college rather, said this ain't true. I say, well, you just ain't reading enough.
You know, to say it's not true, you either have to be ignorant or irrational.
Yeah, which we encounter
right.
almost daily.
Every day. That's man's nature.
Man's answer
is,
to everything.
Right.
You're wrong.
Yeah. And be advised. Yep. When the term Nabi that Yahweh uses for prophet
mm-hmm.
and the test that he provides to determine whether or not he inspired something, where he uses both Haya and Bo,
yeah.
the term Haya means it just to exist.
Mm-hmm.
So what he says had to exist either in the past, history, the present, or the future, predictions of future events. They're actually not predictions, they're future history. And so prophecy from an accurate understanding of the test and the terms that Yahweh uses isn't simply a accurate examples of what's going to occur. It means that if Yanoa inspired it, it is correct historically going all the way back to the first day of creation. So this is history that is being presented before us that you'll find is confirmed in this historical document from Egypt. And it is precisely accurate. Mm-hmm. All right, so what's the next one?
Well, the next one is 925 on the Exodus, and the destruction of the fields is related in these words. And it says, "And the hail smote every herb of the field and brake every tree in the field." And then I'm gonna quote one other thing from the Torah in Psalms 105:33, where they refer back to it. He says, "He smote, probably with hail, their vines and also their fig trees, and they break the trees of the coast." Now, this is important because the Papyrus 4:14 is going to say, "And the trees are destroyed." And also in 6:1, it says, "No fruit nor herbs were are found." So this is a little longer in the Exodus thing, a little shorter in the Papyrus, but still in all, we're still taking the same story at the same time in the next sequence.
And correct.
So we have a couple of things in the Torah that we recite. I mean, go back to that same period of time.
Right. So water, rivers, lakes, and waters turned to blood. No one could find water to drink.
No.
And then the next is the hailstones destroyed every herb and the field and of the every tree. And we have an exact affirmation of both.
Okay.
All right. What's next?
Right, now to go further, we've got the fire spreading all over the land. So in Exodus 9:23-24, the fire ran along upon the ground. There was hail and fire mingled with the hail, very grievous, according to Exodus.
Mm-hmm.
Apri 2:10. I know he didn't say forsooth, but the translator did. Forsooth, gates, columns, and walls are consumed by fire.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a human hand, so it had to
forsooth, meaning, I mean, therefore, as a result,
mm-hmm.
The gates, the columns, and the walls are consumed by fire.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this says that the fire was not spread by human hand, but fell from the sky.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you have here? You've put together what you think are some of the options for this.
Well, you know, you don't know, but... But a lot of the things are, if there is something, if it came from the sky, it can't be hail and fire at the same time. It can be stones.
Right.
And it can be something from a comet. It could be something normal. You know, it's one of those things where you, if I were to put that question to Roy, Roy would say, okay, these are the laws of thermodynamics, and here's the laws of the universe. It has to be one, this or that, the other. So it could be the dust from a comet that causes the blood stuff. But the curious thing is not that there's a scientific or maybe an explanation for this as much as how did Moshe know? No matter what, whenever I get to a little tricky place like here, if it's this and it seems like it wasn't, see, I'm not a big miracle person in the sense that I've got to have a Superman doing something.
No.
He just shows up. Moses shows up. He knows to come there. And he knows what sequence things are going to happen.
Yeah.
He warns him ahead of time.
Yep.
This is a man who's talking to somebody, Yahweh,
yep.
Who's telling him ahead of time, this is what's going to happen next.
Yeah, and by the way, I kind of like the asteroid strike.
Yeah, we know.
Or the comet strike. Yeah, because
strike them down. There was a thing coming.
He saved
who he wanted to save.
Yeah, because at first it's it is something that could create these events, and there would be a so much debris in the air. There would be a hail and also hot stones
mm-hmm.
that are following a significant weather phenomenon after this, and it could be a somewhat regional event. And there's also a lot of interest too in the possibility that some of the hail, both the weather-borne and the fiery kind of hail that was things on fire. And by the way, a comet hit or asteroid hit anywhere in this region, or something even that burst in the sky above this region would create enormous walls of fire.
Yeah.
It's
not unscientific to make these claims. These guys are just honestly recording, both of them are honestly recording what they saw.
Right, plus the fact we know that the great Minoan civilization, which was probably the most advanced in the world at the time, was destroyed right at this time by a tidal wave, something that would be very common with an asteroid hit. And this is when Atlantis, which was part of the on the island of Santorini, ceased to exist because of the volcanic eruption, which could also be caused by the seismic event associated with this.
Now, in the second part of what I go to, which we're not covering today by any means, but the historians from Arabia recorded the same thing, and as did Josephus, and as did Manetho. I may have it wrong, but they record a lot of the same thing. It's what caused the Amalekites, the Amu, as the Egyptians called them, to get on the move. And that's interesting. In the next part, everyone, I show you some of that. That's really fun to do as well. So it's happening certainly all over the region.
We have Santorini. Yeah, we have the Greek islands being impacted. We have the Minoan civilization being destroyed, and we have peoples out of Arabia on migration, very warlike and violent. All as a result of this, and we have immediately thereafter Egypt vulnerable because they have no leadership and they have their infrastructure is destroyed.
When the slaves leave,
In fact, you even wrote down why do we call it the Red Sea? Sur being the Hebrew word and. Residue of any of this could, at this time, would still have it be reddish.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, you've even got a manuscript, I call it Quiche, that from the Mayans, it tells an event that's very similar in the Western Hemisphere. Now, two things about that document or that book. One, they talk about this red stuff that... falls on them, and they also talk about the motion of the sun is interrupted, and when they record that, that's more closer to the time of Joshua, which there's got to be an explanation why the sun would stand still, and over there in the Mayan country, the other side of the hemisphere, on the other side of the earth, they record that the sun didn't come up. I always thought that was relevant. But anyway, I don't want to get too far afield on stuff. They're just some cool stuff. When you start digging, you go, and this and this and this and this and this. But back to Apura, there's a little aside here for a moment where I went into the Exodus 9:31-32 because it has something to do with setting the time as Passover. And I thought it was kind of interesting. So can I go ahead and read that?
Yeah, sure, because we know that it's Passover because, not once but three times speaks about how the barley grain was in the kernel and that it was destroyed. So go ahead.
Yeah, so he goes on in Exodus 9:31-32, the flax and the barley were smitten, for the barley was in the ear and the flax was boiled. But the wheat
what is the Hebrew word for barley is in the ear?
Oh,
it's the name of the month.
Nisan.
No, that's the rabbinical name for the month based upon their time in Babylon. It's the same month. It's just but Yahweh actually has a name. The name Nisan is the rabbinical name, if you will. Yahweh's word is Abib.
Abib.
Abib means that the barley kernels are green and growing in the plant, not ready yet for harvest, but nearly so. It's Abib, and so he's establishing this incident to establish the time of year, which is Abib, because on the 14th day of Abib. And by the way, we're not to the 14th day. We are just at Abib. That's the start of the month. The start of the month is the new moon. Yeah, it's the new moon, right? Or the first crescent of the moon, when the barley is Abib. So he's telling us that. Oh, by the way, pay attention now. It's Abib.
Mm-hmm.
So the Passover took place on Passover, 14 days, thereafter.
then I went on to say, after the next plague, the fields became utterly barren, like in Exodus 10, 15 and above. Mm-hmm. The papyrus relates no duty could be rendered to the crown for the wheat and the barley. And he's going to talk about that a little bit further in 10:3. Exodus 7:21. Now, this is just kind of a lot of stuff thrown together here to cover this little area. Mm-hmm. And the fish that were in the river died, and there was no fish for the royal household. And then in Papyri 10:3-6, you have Lower Egypt weeps. This is Apura again. The entire palace is without its revenues. To it belongs the rights, the wheat, the barley, the geese, and the fish. So they can't tax them now. They don't get anything from the house. It's for the royal house. So it's obviously all the fields are devastated.
Yes. So, and each of these plagues, too, was specifically designed to refute the existence and the and to expose the impotence of the Egyptian gods, because they had a god for each of these things that was now happening to them. And it showed, yeah, it showed, oh, by the way, you know, your god of this, your god of that, I'm sorry. Yeah, he is not going to come to your rescue. He doesn't exist.
You're useless god.
Yes. Okay, so
okay. 101s. Here we have Exodus 10:15. There remains not any green thing in the trees or in the herbs of the field throughout all the land of Egypt. And the papyrus says 6:3.
By the way, you know, just a little thing. Yeah, what was the Hebrew name for the land of Egypt?
Mizraim.
Yeah, Mizraim. What do the Egyptians call themselves today?
Mitzri.
Yeah, in Egypt is from the Greek. Mm-hmm. The Egyptians refer to themselves as Mitzri today, and Yahweh coined this name Mitzriim, for which is just the plural of Mitzra, to describe the country 3,500 years ago. Pretty interesting. You know, the other thing that's really interesting about, and I didn't mention it, but that just historically gratifying, if you like this stuff. Mm-hmm. When the Torah wrote that the city was Ramses, the Torah is a vocalized alphabet, and so by using the vowels and the consonants that exist in Hebrew, the name of the Egyptian gods and pharaohs and cities could be pronounced 2,000 years before we found the Rosetta Stone and learned how to read and pronounce the Egyptian hieroglyphics.
Wow, that's cool.
As soon as they said, wait a minute, now we can read this, and it says that Ramses, and now we look at the Hebrew, and it says Ramses. Mm. Why didn't they say, wow, that's a, what are the odds that that happened by chance?
Oh,
you know, the founder of Mormonism, Joseph Smith.
Yeah,
Joseph Smith, you know, was handed a hieroglyphic tablet before the Rosetta Stone, and because he claimed that his great capability was that he could translate ancient languages that no one else knew how to read. And so, you know, he was he was given a tablet, which we now know came from the Book of the Dead. And he said, oh, this is about the Lord's meeting with Abraham. And of course, it was a chant from the Book of the Dead. And so he proved that he was wholly and completely unreliable, the founder of the Mormon religion. Well, Yahweh, as the author of the Torah, proved that he was completely and totally reliable, both with the name of the country, Mitzra, and Mitzrayim, just the plural of Mitzra, and with Ramses' name, as well as the litany of plagues here.
Wow, that's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. Depending on where we are in time, let me just do Exodus 10:15.
Okay.
There remains not any green thing in the trees, and there's no herbs in the fields throughout the land. And then the papyrus 6:3 says, grain has perished and on every side. virus in the 512, which is just right before it. It says that that has perished, which yesterday was seen. The land is left over to its weariness like the cutting of flax. Now, the reason that's important is because yesterday it was not seen. So I made a little note down here that this obviously is saying that this happened all in one day. This is not a drought. It's not a bad harvest. You can't turn it into something other than is either hail, fire, or locust got it.
Yeah, and by the way, it's also interesting that the talking about the harvest that is was not seen. Barley shoots up very quickly and greens up very quickly, saying that so that barley didn't even exist before it was, you know, shortly before it was destroyed. And also, what other plant did it mix? The papyrus 512. What other plant? Flax. What are the two plants that Yahweh mentions? Barley and flax.
Yeah. Pretty cool.
Pretty cool.
Back here in, that's, now for those listening and ain't got the book in front of them, it's 9:31-32. Flax right. And barley. First thing
correct.
Out of Exodus, yeah.
Yep.
So now you're going to see, and then I went to Psalms 105:34-35, and the locusts came, the caterpillars, and them without number, and they did eat up all the herbs in the land, and they devoured the fruit of the land. And then again in Papyrus 6:1, he mentions no fruit nor herbs are found hungry, and then some words missing, and then it says hunger.
Right, and herbs, by the way, doesn't mean herbs in the sense of spices.
No.
It means grains that would be used to create. Guess what the primary purpose of growing grain was in Egypt?
I'm sure bread.
Nope.
No? Oh, nope. Making beer, of course.
Making beer. Making beer.
Yeah.
Budweiser. That's right, Budweiser. Without beer, there is no human civilization. Yeah, you've got to have beer. So, you know, they were using it to make beer. You know, it's a lot of barley beers even now. A lot of, you know, grain-based beers, wheat beers even.
Sure.
Okay. So let's, we still have a complete synchronization of these two accounts.
Yeah.
And now, mind you, one is being written, written by an eyewitness who's inspired by Yahweh. And the other is being written by a eyewitness who is, who is inspired by false gods. I mean, they weren't trying to corroborate one another.
No, they have no idea of each other's writing.
No.
No, he's writing it, and obviously Moshe doesn't know he's doing his thing either. So
right.
So in Exodus 9:3, the hand of Yahweh is upon the cattle which is in the field. There shall be a grievous moraine. I looked this up because moraine is not a word you use a lot in English.
Right.
And it means an infectious and fatal disease among cattle. And interesting, Webster's dictionary says means red water. This red dust that falls on you, you know, it can kill you, as well as all that other stuff that's falling. So,
right, yeah, that's
so
true.
It's itchy and painful, and it kills the cattle. And then, amazingly, in the papyrus of 5:5, all the animals, their hearts weep, cattle moan. Hail and fire made the frightened cattle to flee. Now, I followed that with Exodus 9:19, gather their cattle, Yahweh was telling them, gather your cattle, and all that you have in the field, 9:21, Exodus, and he that regarded not the word of Yahweh left his servants and his cattle in the field.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this parallels also Papyri 9:2-3. Behold, cattle are left to stray, and there is none to gather them together. Each man fetches for himself that those that are branded with his name.
Now, isn't that interesting that it's exactly the same concept? Yahweh says, you better bring in your cattle.
It's going to hit the cattle.
Yeah, and then saying not only is the cattle moaning and really going through a tough time here, it's saying, hey, you know, we didn't follow the advice. We didn't send people out to get the cattle. So, you know, individuals are straying out now, but it's too little too late.
Yeah. And then
it's right to the details.
Yeah. And I made a note, how do you make this stuff up?
Yeah.
How would you coordinate that and put it in, plug it in? And why would you do it way long time ago? Because there was nothing to gain by it.
Well, of course, the person that wrote this was writing it to...
A thousand years later, what would you
gain by? Right, yeah, the person writing this was bemoaning the fact that his position of power and his kingdom, pharaohdom, if you will, in Egypt, was everything was destroyed. And that his gods were impotent in trying to do it. The Pharaoh was impotent in trying to do it. And that he had lost everything as a result. And he's bemoaning that. And he's writing it at the same time.
Yeah.
Describing the plagues.
It's too amazing to disregard this kind of stuff.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, it kind of blew me away. For
okay, so the ninth plague. What do we read on the ninth plague?
The next plague in Exodus 10:22, and there is a thick darkness in the land.
Related to dust. I mean, Yahweh even had Moshe blow out of his hand some dust to show them what was going to happen here.
Yeah, and it's the Papyrus 9:11 says the land is not light. Or without light, and it's very, very, or dark. The thing about that, and I was reading a lot about what he had done.
You know, by the way, you know what's interesting here? I just have to stop you for a second here. You know, there are, for those who are following along, say, wait a minute, you've skipped some of the plagues, like, for example, the frogs and the locusts. No. Okay, I know. I know, and it's, but you've skipped a few of those flags, and you've obviously skipped them because they're not in the papyrus.
Yeah,
well, it's interesting, but it's interesting, but it's, but no, but okay, but also be aware, the priesthood of the Pharaoh replicated the plagues of the frogs and the locusts. That's what's so fascinating about the whole thing, is that Pharaoh, rather than having his priesthood eliminate the frogs and the locusts, actually made more of them. And so the reason that a priest wouldn't mention the frogs and the locusts, particularly the frogs, is because they were duped into making more of them. He's not going to say, oh, yeah, there's this frog thing, but we're really culpable. We're culpable on the frog thing. Yeah. So when you read what the Pharaoh's response was to some of the early plagues, you've got culpability with the Egyptian priesthood, which is why there's a few of them that they just, well, let's just skip over that one because we don't look so smart. Yeah, that didn't work out too well for us. Okay. But then after a while, Pharaoh just gives up and he says, okay, it's obviously that I'm wrong here. And so Pharaoh gives up and said, all right, we'll do it differently. We'll play by your rules. And then of course, once he does that, he then reneges each time after he's done that. All right. So now we're at the ninth plague and we have no light in the land and papyrus.
There's a section somewhere, and I don't know if I put it in there, but it explains some of how dark it really was. Because there's some discrepancy between some historians who have the plague going for 7 days, and maybe it was up or maybe someone else. But the Torah talks about 3 days, but the Torah only says if for 3 days you couldn't move, and that's what some of the Egyptian historians had said at the same time. So even though they may have been very dark in the land for 7 or 8 days,
yes.
But three of them, they couldn't. They didn't know what. They just laid down to die because they couldn't see across the room. It was thick.
Right.
Whatever the darkness was. It was a bad news.
So. Right. And from beginning to end, from the first plague to the last plague, you've got about 14 days. So this also has to play out fairly rapidly.
Yeah.
All the going back and forth with the Pharaoh and Moshe, and some of the plagues were remedied. Yahweh and Moshe said, all right, we won't bother you with that one anymore. Some of them were not, but some of them were remedied, and it takes place in 14 days because coming...
If you don't remedy them, how are you going to get the slaves out?
Right.
I mean, it becomes a practical thing. If these things are not going to clear out at some point, you ain't going to clear out either, and he's on a time scale.
Right.
Because,
right.
Pesach is coming.
So we'll pick up with the 10th plague in our program this evening. May God bless.